Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
Summer's here, I'm for that. I got my rubber sandals, got my straw hat, I got my cold beer, I'm just glad that it's here. Summer's here, that suits me fine. It may rain today, 'cause I don't mind. It's my favorite time of the year, and I'm glad that it's here.
That, of course, is James Taylor expressing his love and optimism and happiness about summer. And that is one of the things we're going to talk about on The Nose today, because that does describe the attitude of many, many people towards summer. And our guest today, Tanisha Dugan, a producing associate at TheaterWorks, Jacques Lamar, the playwright and director of client services at Buzz Engine, and Bill Usman, a director of media studies at Sacred Heart University, will talk about whether they're really kind of in the James Taylor camp, or they are they a little bit more wolfy in this camp?
Kiss me hard before you go.
Actually, if Lana Del Rey is connected in any way to your sense of a season, it's probably not going to go all that well. So that's going to be our top topic today. We'll lead off the show with that. But let me just tell you, in the future of the show, we're going to talk about the future of streaming, TV streaming. And then we've also been to see Spider-Man Far From Home. I should say that what we really wanted to do this week is have everybody go see Pavarotti, this tremendous documentary that's playing in three locations around the state, including Will Wilkins wants me to tell you at Real Art Ways, it's not true that you can't see it, but you have to go to either 1 p.m. or 3 p.m., which is highly inconvenient to our panel. So we couldn't do this, but it's really just a tremendous documentary, and you should go see it. And if you don't like opera, that doesn't mean anything. It's like not watching Friday Night Lights because you don't like football. Anyway, we'll come to all of that. But right now we have to talk about summer the occasion for that. Oh, I also have to say that TheaterWorks has its play pen weekend of new play readings next weekend, July 19th through the 21st. Both Jacques and Tanisha, and putatively Bill, also want you to know that live, bold new plays from some of the most exciting on the horizon voices in the industry are coming. These are playwrights you should know sharing their plays at early stages of development. It's always fun. Those kinds of play reading festivals and stuff like that. So good. Good times. Good summer times or not.
Good
so,
summer times.
The occasion for this conversation is a Washington Post essay by Elahi Izadi. I hope I'm saying that right. Found people who found summer terribly depressing. People who like eating dinner by candlelight. Dark city nights invigorate them, but bright summer days do not. And the extra daylight doesn't make them feel good. Et cetera, et cetera. So that there is kind of a summer seasonal affective disorder in addition to the winter seasonal affective disorder. So let's hear how everybody processed that. Well, you're doing some body language over there, so
I
that
did.
Means you have to
start. Because I said I called BS on summer seasonal disorder.
Really?
I think it's just grumpy.
Really?
I think if you're just grumpy, you're grumpy. I get it if it's, it's cold, it's dark, you can't go outside. Not to hate on people's disorders, but I'm going to call that one and go, I don't know. I think you just don't want to have a good time.
Well, as somebody who I do get depressed in the summer, and it's probably easily my least favorite of the four seasons. I like all other three seasons better. I know.
Audible
I know.
Gasp.
You're not a rosé all day kind of guy,
I am
I guess.
I am with you.
Yeah? I feel good. I feel like there's somebody else.
I'm a summer hater.
Because I was getting summer shamed over here.
You were. It's true.
So Jacques, talk about that.
To me, I don't. It doesn't come down to feeling, having a feeling of depression or what have you. I don't like the heat. I don't like, not that the beach isn't available at other times of year, but I don't like going to the beach, and which is something I thought my husband and I shared in common. But as soon as I think he realized that I don't enjoy the beach, he suddenly liked it. So most of our vacations end up going somewhere warm near the beach. But, you know, I'd rather be inside by a fire with a cup of cocoa or something. I don't know.
It just doesn't work in the summer. None of that works in the summer. No, you just can't do it.
It's depressing.
I think that for Jacques and I to say these things, Bill, it requires tremendous personal courage on our parts because, yeah, I mean, people look at you funny when you say all that, you know, because I have mostly masked my feelings about this, and I try to, like, be, yeah, summer, yeah, like everybody else, you know, but I'm really not feeling it.
Yeah, well, try saying that in Miami and see the kind of looks that you get.
Well, you have to say it in, like, six different languages, first of
all. Well, true, starting with Yiddish, and which I can say.
He can make that joke.
I can make that joke, because I'm a real mensch. I love summer, but I also recognize there are some specific reasons I love summer that are related to my privileged position in the world. Mm-hmm. For one thing, being a college professor, summer is my best time of year.
Right.
I teach in a graduate program that actually has classes all year long, but I tend to pull back in the summer. I get a lot more autonomy. I get a lot more freedom. I can read a lot more. I can spend my days the way I want to spend them. And I totally get that that's not true for everyone, mm-hmm. or actually not true for most people. So it, you know, if you're just schlepping off to work and it's 95 degrees, I can see why that could be depressing and bothersome.
No, actually, we're glad to go to work when it's 95 degrees. We want to be at work. Yeah. We don't want to be outside trying to make that work. That is the thing. So what do you think is so great about summer?
I love the long days. I love the sun, obviously. I think since I saw you last, I've changed like 3 shades darker. I just, everything about it. I love no rules. Mm-hmm. I don't like structure. Summer is the perfect season for a lack of structure. Winter, you know, everyone's on you. There's places to go. There's things to do. There are deadlines to be met. Summer, a little less so.
I mean, Jacques, one thing that I try to do to cope is to fill up my summer with, first of all, I don't want to be out in the middle of the day. I just don't want any part of that, all right?
No.
So morning is pretty good. Evening is fine. This week, yesterday, I like to go out. I try to see a lot of outdoor stuff. Yesterday, because we taped, I got to run downtown and see my guys, Self-Suffice, Kaim the Rap Poet, and Tang Sauce out there rapping by the Old State House. I was watching my friend LaTanya Farrell perform in Elizabeth Park on Wednesday night. I was at Monday Night Jazz on Monday. But I'm faking it, you know? I'm faking it. I'm trying to be like one of the people having a good time during the summer. Because I don't know about you, but it is, you know, you can't really like say that. It's like almost you sound un-American or something.
Yeah, every time I would go to my dermatologist, every meeting would end with, and stay out of the sun.
Right.
Or, you know, make sure you wear sunblock, which I hate wearing sunblock.
Mm-hmm.
So I like, you know, I would be content in starting basically Memorial Day, staying in my basement. I know people love going to outdoor concerts and theater and what have you. I am a big fan of, you can't have weather contingent anything, you know, that everything should happen in a bunker or, you know,
or a black box.
Yeah. I mean,
a black box theater,
a number of my clients, like the Otto Reno Center is doing the outdoor Shakespeare right
yes.
now with Capitol Classics, which is wonderful. And, you know, I was helping with promoting Black Eyed and Blues Fest in Bushnell Park. And I want to support people who have this lifestyle choice of wanting to be out where insects can get at you. Because of my general aversion to humanity and nature, summer seems to bring out those two things.
It's true.
Either that or Jacques and I were both dogs in a previous life because we're just going.
Yeah,
you have the floor.
And I'm the cat who's like rolling in the sunbeam and showing my belly. Not that anyone wants to see that. But yeah, I like Tanisha, I crave the sun.
And you too are a few shades darker than I saw you last.
Absolutely. I'm out there all the time. And I absolutely love the long days. In the article that we read, you know, one of the points they make is kind of a scientific point about sleep deprivation and how it's harder to sleep when the days are longer and there's more sun. I stay up till 1 or 2 in the morning anyway, regardless, no matter what the season is. So that doesn't really bother me.
I felt like a winning parent because in my fantasy, good parents have their kids going to bed just as the sun is setting. So I feel like real hero because I'm like, look, it's 8:30 and the sun is just setting and my kids are going to bed.
It's like Amish parents do that, I think. But I'm not sure like other parents do that.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. I would like to qualify that I'm a fan of dusk.
Dusk. Yeah. Dusk is nice.
Oh, dusk is
nice.
Dusk. Yeah.
I mean, the minute it stops being a summer day – how shall I compare thee to a summer? I don't want to. When it stops being a summer day, I start getting happier. So I think that's part of the key.
We so summer nights, so you're
like
kind of like
Olivia Newton-John.
Exactly.
And you.
Or a vampire.
Live for those summer nights.
Or a vampire, yeah. All right, so we may have exhausted this subject, but it's clear anyway that there are points of view about this, which may be held on each side by basically decent people. And so there you go. As usual, we've accomplished nothing. But other than to get ready to move on to the future of television. So I'll try to set this up a little bit. I thought with like a professor of media studies here, I feel like I shouldn't have to do too much of the heavy lifting. But so basically what's happening, what's going to happen very soon is that every big player in the media industry and a whole bunch of players that you've never heard of are going to be adding more streaming channels, carrying more streaming channels. So Disney Plus, Apple Plus, all kinds of players are getting into the industry. There are ways in which all of these things are going to be bundled and configured in different ways. And there's just a tremendous amount of places to go and get content, more places than you could easily go to get content. I'm sure you've had the experience of having, you know, a hearing about something that sounds kind of interesting and they say it's on Acorn or something and you go, well, what's that? You know, and there's going to be more and more of that. So there's a massive piece in the Sunday New York Times Magazine about this very fact. It is called The Great Race to Rule Streaming TV. All right, Mr. Media Studies Professor, why don't you take us off on some tangent here?
All right, let me get my chalk and start drawing. I think it's absolutely true that the entire media environment is transforming in ways that we had not anticipated, and we actually don't know where all of this is going to end up. I think it's impossible to predict where this is going to be 5-10 years from now. In this article in the New York Times, they try to do that. And they paint, I think, a picture of both possibilities and some real serious potential pitfalls. Because what we have is I think a dialectical tension between more and more democracy in terms of production, more and more democracy in terms of consumption. When I was growing up, we had the three channels. You watched one of them, and that's really all you had. Now, the field is wide open for more and more producers, more diverse stories, more experimentation, more flexibility. All of that, I think, is absolutely a good thing. But the other side of that is there is a tension there with the quality of what's being produced. When there's more and more and more, there's also more and more and more just really bad stuff, really trashy stuff that, you know, who has time for all of that?
And I also feel as though, and I think this is a point that is made occasionally in this piece, that, you know, we've sort of lived through the period, a 20 to 30 year period of exactly what you've described, where, you know, creative stuff done by high quality talents. I mean, I think it's made in, I read so many pieces I've lost track, but I think it's in this piece where they say, you know, you could do The Sopranos because there were all these creative people, really great actors and writers and directors and all this kind of stuff, and they all wanted to work on something like this because there was nothing like that to work on. on, you know, and now there's so you couldn't get that group of people together to work on The Sopranos. They're all doing their own little projects all over the place. And meanwhile, I think for the big telecom companies, they're looking at this kind of the way we look at the Democratic candidates for president. There's too much. It's got to get whittled down somehow. They're all about throwing their big ugly arms around as much of it as they can get. But I think they probably think there's way, way too much. And I don't know. So I don't know. Tanisha, what's your relationship to all this stuff?
I got a couple. One, I think I too have loved some prestige theater, prestige television. And I think that the environment isn't as ripe for prestige TV. I think it's expensive. I think we're even finding, you know, Netflix is pulling back on how much it's expending on productions because the return isn't as great. I think in theory, the idea that there's lots of content to pick from and then sort of the major content producers select one, in the example of like Issa Rae and Awkward Black Girl, right, that came through YouTube, and then you're able to like invest in those artists in a way that is like prestige TV is interesting. But I also think it does this weird thing where it asks all content creators and makes everyone a content creator, and therefore people who are putting out platforms want things done. And I think that's why you're getting a lot of crappy done things, because it's not so much about the idea. Let's talk about this idea. Let's talk about your dreams for what this idea is. It's James Gandolfini, and it's just about, you know, this one mafia, you know, family. It's fast and dirty and loose, and I think that doesn't always make for great art.
Jacques?
I'm not sure that prestige television will fade away. I mean, there's still, you know, things that are being churned out, and I think that those things will, by virtue of their quality to a certain extent, tap into the zeitgeist and kind of bubble up to the surface. I mean, to me, in reading that article, I was just overwhelmed at the thought of it. I'm the kind of person who likes Trader Joe's because it removes choice from my life. It's like, I know I want this, and therefore I will buy the Trader Joe's brand of it. I love that you can watch what you want when you want with streaming. The whole thing of like, I have to wait until Tuesday night to watch this, or I have to set my VCR or whatever in case I miss it, or DVR or what have you. You know, I think being able to ingest stuff and on a timeline that works for me is really great. Having to wait, you know, it's interesting because when you look at like Game of Thrones, you had to get back into a certain sense into that old viewing habit of appointment television.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think it worked for that show. But at the same time, to go, because the production was so massive, to wait a year and a half. Like, I'm watching the new Stranger Things season, and I have to be like, what happened a year ago? I have to remember that level of detail. Now, I can go back and watch it again, which is what I'm sure Netflix would want. But so there's aspects of like the binging that is really great because you can see like a whole artistic statement at, you know, at one time, or kind of parse it out as you wish. But I'm very conflicted about the streaming things. As a certain radio show asked me to watch a channel that I did not have. So I downloaded the app, and I'm like, all right, I have to remember to cancel this because otherwise they're going to charge me $7 a month.
And that's a big part of this, right, for all of this stuff. You know, I mean, a lot of us have, you know, I added YouTube something so that we could watch the Cobra Kai sequel.
YouTube Red,
yeah. Right? And then it was like on my credit card bill, and I was just not getting rid of it. And I think a lot of people are carrying those things over. We've got Hulu now. We'll just jump back onto Showtime if there's something there that we really want to see, but then you have to remember, CBS All Access, which was really hard to get rid of, by the way. It takes a lot of work to get CBS All Access. And that's another problem, which is that
that's the gag.
If you are really into Handmaid's Tale, First of all, you either just have to keep Hulu for a really long time or drop Hulu at the end of season two. Remember to pick Hulu back up at the end of season three. You know, they've got us spending a lot of time trying to
and
figure
money.
All that crap out. And
so
money.
So
yeah.
much well, money because you don't – like, you know, the $6.99 or the $4.99 for the different levels of packages. And then you – most of the time you don't remember. And then yeah. you've got like more than a regular cable bill would cost, right? And people like balk because they see that one charge every month and it's huge. But you don't pay attention to like 10 yeah. $4.99 a
yeah.
month.
Nose panelist Carolyn Payne apparently still has CBS All Access yeah. because of us. There's going to be somebody from CBS All Access at Carolyn's funeral, you know, 70 years from now saying, thanks for subscribing for all these decades, including during the Martian occupation and stuff like that. What were we going to say?
Well, the other thing that the article brings out, which speaks directly to this, is that for the corporate executives, this is product. This mm-hmm. isn't, you know, this isn't the other, I think the other dialectical tension that's here is between art and commerce. And of course, there's always, you know, there is no art that is totally free of commerce. You know, there never has been. But that, the, I think of these corporate executives in the same way that I think of condo developers. You see a space where you think, oh, there could be five nice little houses there. They're not going to put in five nice little houses. They're going to put in 15. They're going to put in 20 where people are living in these cramped quarters close to each other. And, you know, they use the phrase in the article, this is all about the monetization of attention. Mm-hmm. Because people are watching now on their phones, they're watching everywhere, and you've got to grab them with these little bits of content. But what does that mean in terms of storytelling? What does that mean in terms of character development? What does that mean in terms of what makes narrative so compelling and important for us? They quote from one of these executives in the article who calls a program pitch so stupid but so sellable. Mm-hmm. They don't care that it's stupid. All they care about is that it's sellable. They also use the phrase good enough TV. Well, good enough for who? Like good enough just to make some money over off of it. But what is it in terms of why human beings are attracted to stories in the first place? That I think is a potential problem. Yes, the technology opens space up and it allows for experimentation. It allows for diversity. Those are all very, very good things. But the technology is being controlled by these corporate conglomerates that don't care about any of that.
Right. And to your point, Tanisha, one of the things we don't know, I think, is did Issa Rae get where she is right now because she was so talented she was going to get someplace? That's what I'd like to believe, and that in this proliferation of platforms and stuff like that, Issa Rae is just going to rise to the top. Or did she get there because Richard Plepler, who is kind of a non-speaking protagonist of this article, Richard Plepler, who I've gotten to know pretty well over the years, you know, insisted on getting somebody like that and was willing to, you know, and has been – was repeatedly during his time at HBO willing to pay for stuff, willing to push creators. Alan Ball described going into HBO with kind of a more kind of good enough TV kind of pitch and having the HBO people say, no, what's the thing you really want to do? We don't hear about that. That's like – that's very sellable. We want to hear about the thing you think you can – and that's how Six Feet Under actually happened, was HBO said, give me this – give us the stuff that you're afraid to talk about. We want to do that thing. And I what I wonder, Jacques, is I feel like one effect that this is having on me, and it kind of goes back to what Bill was just saying, is – I don't have the kind of commitment to stuff that I used to have. It's like I don't know. I binged a lot of Handmaid's Tale recently, and then I don't know. We were just saying yesterday, oh, should we get rid of Hulu? And the one I live with said, are you all done with Handmaid's Tale? I said, no, but yeah, I don't know. You know, it's like,
will
you
they
know,
ask me again?
I don't really care a lot of times. I can stop watching something because there's so much other stuff out there.
Well, you know, I think this may not be answering your question, but I think one of the things is we have to rethink what is television, because television used to mean you had to sit on the couch, pick up your remote, and watch TV. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now you really have to think in terms of screens, your phone, your tablet, mm-hmm. your computer at work. You know, I was not really watching but listening to Mike Daisy do the first part of his 32-hour performance of his adaptation of Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States. And so I was like ingesting content while working. And I thought one of the most fascinating things about the article was the commodification of your attention and the fact that they that their mission is to figure out how to take up more hours of your life.
Right. Yes.
And yes. that it was supposed to be you would have a four-hour block and maybe of, you know, that normally you would, when you sat in front of a TV on a daily basis or whatever, you know, you said, all right, this hour is going to go to The Sopranos because this is when it's on. And I, you know, that FOMO, you know, I can't wait for the rebroadcast to have to watch it now kind of thing. And so now it's saying, you know, my television viewing can start in the morning and it can continue on my commute. Mm-hmm. And it can happen at my desk when my boss isn't watching. And so I think one of the things that's really fascinating about this is also the willingness to get away from the half hour or 22 minute format or the full hour format and say a show can be 10 minutes.
Right. And we should mention that, first of all, one of the things they mentioned in this article is that AT&T is trying to come up with a way to do a 20-minute Game of Thrones episode at it, with the idea being people watch on their phones. They're not going to hold their phone for more than 20 minutes. And so we are doing a show next Thursday that will involve all three of the people that you're hearing on the show today. We're doing a show on Thursday about how everything's getting shorter, everything's getting smaller. One of the things that we did was watch a new series that is being released in 10-minute episodes. And so all of our panelists here will be talking on a very, very short episode of The Nose on Thursday.
But we each only get 30 seconds to talk.
Right. You have to talk really fast, too.
So I've already wasted my time.
And right. what we each have done, I think, is probably watched it in more than 10-minute chunks,
which
is sort of the opposite of what the intention of creating content that small is all about. So I think, you know, to your earlier point about what does this mean for the quality of it, I think that that commodification of attention means I don't care what the quality of the thing is. I just care that you're watching it. I mean,
my son watches
the crappiest things on YouTube, right? Like
yes.
food toys, how to cut his Play-Doh into, you know, peanut butter and jelly. None of it is good. It's all, you know, made on a phone. And I think the loss for me as a content creator, that's something that I do that I've, as a craftsperson, is that the work isn't that great. Because they don't really care.
Yeah.
And there's no one who's really playing Oz and looking at the plethora of things that a particular platform is offering and really curating it. I mean, you could find anything pretty much everywhere. And I wonder if that becomes the future, right?
I think that's going to be somebody else's job, too. I think you're going to hear there are going to be people who come out or going to have their own channels or whatever on YouTube who are going to tell you which things you need to pay attention to and which things are crap.
Yeah.
And you'll decide whether over time you believe that person or this other person. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we've got to wrap this up so we can talk about Spider-Man in Europe. and, well, anyway, we'll just get to that.
I hate summer. I hate summer.
All right, so one of the other things that we did this week is to go to the movies. You'll notice that Carolyn Payne is not on this episode of the show because she basically will never do this again. But we went to see Spider-Man Far From Home.
Now I know why.
Yes, well, yeah, exactly. So Tom Holland, the young actor who's taken over the role of Spider-Man, has, I think it's fair to say, in the past, breathed quite a bit of new life into this character and done some interesting things with the help of a big creative team. This time we find him in Europe on a class field trip to Europe. And Europe being kind of a place you go as opposed to like a whole bunch of specific places. But yes, we go from Venice to Prague to Berlin to London. And here's just a little bit of it. You're going to hear Jake Gyllenhaal as Quentin Beck, Colby Smulders as Mariah Hill, Tom Holland as Spider-Man, Samuel L. Jackson, who else, as Nick Fury in this little clip here.
They were born in stable orbits within black holes, creatures formed from the primary elements, air, water, fire, earth. The science division had a technical name. We just called them elementals.
Versions of them exist across our mythologies.
Turns out the myths are real.
Like Thor. Thor was a myth, and now I study him in my physics class. These myths are threats.
They first materialized on my Earth many years ago. I was part of the last battalion left trying to stop them. All we did was delay the inevitable.
The elementals are here now, attacking the same coordinates. Our satellites confirm it.
We have one mission. Kill it. And you're coming with us.
Mr. Fury, this all seems like big time. You know, huge superhero kind of stuff. And, I mean, I'm just a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, sir.
Please, you've been to space.
All right, so Tanisha, we could contextualize all of that for people, but I think the truth is, as far as you're concerned, and I'm concerned, and Bill's concerned, I'm not sure where Jacques is on this. It kind of doesn't really matter what the heck they're talking about.
It doesn't, and that's sad, because I really do like...
Speaking of a reduction in quality.
Yeah, because I really do enjoy Marvel films. I do. And this one, I just was like, ugh, why? Which was unfortunate. I don't love Tom, I guess, which is part of it. Mm. I think I've loved, you know, what's his name?
Don't say Andrew Garfield. Don't you say Andrew Garfield.
No, the one. No,
Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, you know. And maybe that's because that was like the formative time when I was really like into it and watching it. But, and I found myself confused and I found myself longing for Iron Man and just really being like, oh,
actually,
man.
That should be the subtitle of this movie anyway. Longing for Iron Man. Spider-Man. Yeah. Longing for Iron Man. Because there's a lot of wistfulness and Tony Stark missing, and Tony Stark schmurs. And that seems to be driving a lot of it. I know what you mean by confusing, too, because there's no point in trying to recap the plotter. But there's like this thing that goes on all the time, and it's very hard to understand how it could possibly work and whether it works. And
yes,
it's
exactly.
It's bananas. It's,
yeah. And so I don't know.
It's the ultimate in projection mapping.
But Bill, on the other hand, I mean, this thing has all the stuff in it that we have, a lot of the stuff in it that we have typically liked in the past. It has some snappy patter. It does have, you know, some of us don't like Tom Holland, but if you like Tom Holland, he's got this kind of quippy, very high school-y kind of, you know, way of doing Spider-Man. It's sort of hard to figure out why is it so, to use yours and Tanisha's term, meh, Spider-meh.
Oh, I could go on for a long time about how much I did not like this movie. And like Tanisha, I am a Marvel Cinematic Universe fan. I've literally been reading Marvel comic books for 50 years. And so I'm not prone to just have kind of like this snobbish attitude about superhero movies. I generally like them. To me, this was – so we know that Disney owns Marvel. To me – this was the Disney Kids Channel version of a Marvel movie. When I was growing up, I was watching all those bad sitcoms like The Brady Bunch and The Partridge Family, and it seemed like there would always be like an episode where they were off to France or they were off to London or they were off to Rome. It's so bad. It's just like this postcard travelogue.
With the worst soundtrack.
The worst soundtrack.
Why?
It's like the High School Musical version of a Marvel movie. One of the things that I have liked about some of the recent Marvel movies is the darkness of them, the kind of dark grandeur of them, if you will, and the very melancholy, especially we talked about.
We should say that Bill is the voice of Thanos on those Avengers movies. That's one of the – see, he kind of has a dog in the fight, but go ahead.
And I'm also down with vanishing half the world's population too, by the way, but that's a more complicated story. So it's just okay.
I like those aspects too, and yet I hated them in MJ. I'm like, what happened to the girl that he like? Why is she this like sullen, sully? Like she's just.
Although Zendaya plays.
What's up with her?
Zendaya plays MJ, who's the Spider-Man's love
interest.
I think she's the closest thing to saving this movie, though. You know,
her
she is an interesting actress, but I feel that character does not belong in this movie. So yes, that was interesting to watch, and there was real character development happening. But who is this girl? Like, why is she in this movie? She's the love interest.
Love interest.
And she should be like bubbly, and you know. She's going to be a reporter.
So, Jacques, is part of the problem – I mean, first of all, I think this stuff is all getting – we have some fatigue, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even if we like MCU, you know, I mean, we're getting tired. I'm getting tired. And I'm like Bill. I grew up a comic book nerd, you know, and I'm still tired.
But you went. I mean, that's the part of what we were talking about.
I wanted to do Pavarotti.
This is
now,
true.
I hate opera, but now I wish we had.
Yeah. I don't hate opera, but I mean, the thing is, for some reason, I'm still in that, fear of missing out and and like, oh, you know, I've got to collect them all and share them with my friends kind of thing. And it's like, you know, there's starting to blur in my mind. I'm trying to figure out, you know, what the issue was with Andrew Garfield. I don't remember disliking him, but, you know, I mean, these things get more and more bloated. I mean, the most interesting thing in this movie is the after credits.
Yeah,
agreed.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah, the and stuff so that you like, have to sit and wait for were actually better.
Right.
Yeah. So go see Midsommar, and then right before the end, leave Slip and out. Go see Spider-Man. Final 5 minutes.
Right. I mean, this is how we movie now, is that when you go to see these Marvel things, you have to sit there and you have to – there's a punch one, which is halfway through the credits at the end, and then dead end of the credits. You've watched – and could I just say one thing about this too? So yesterday I was at the Bloomfield Cinemas, 10 minutes of commercials, just commercials for like vitamin water and crap like that, and then 20 minutes of promo of trailers. So 30 minutes – so I arrived at 5:10, which was the listed showtime. I don't know why I did that. I know better. But, you know, and I got out of there pretty close to 8 o'clock because I also had to wait all the way through the credits to see the very last thing.
It is hilarious that you're saying this because I also went to the Bloomfield Cinema and I was outraged by the number of commercials before the movie started to the extent where I started – yelling about it in the theater and totally.
Oh, you were that guy.
My kids and my wife were totally embarrassed. My son was telling me just to shut up, but it was outrageous.
Dad, please be quiet.
And but it's actually related to something that we've been talking about, that this is all product. Mm-hmm. It's just product. And the fact that you had to sit through 15 minutes of commercials before you got to then this product of a film. It was annoying.
I think also this isn't – I'm suddenly remembering. I think it's the most recent – but not counting Into the Spider-Verse – the most recent Spider-Man movie before this one. Was it the one where he kept getting detentions and they'd have to go and they'd watch these instructional films where Captain America would be telling them how to be better citizens and stuff like that? And then at the end, you wait through all the credits to the final, final second punch thing, and Captain America comes on and just talks about how it's important to learn to wait, you know, and to be patient. He goes, even if sometimes you wait a really long time and what you waited for turns out not to be all that great, you know, and then that's kind of the end, and we can all kind of laugh at this little joke that's happened. I just want to say one thing about this, and anybody, whoever wants to, can react. I think, okay, you don't like Tom Holland that much, but
he's okay.
I think one of the things they did very well early on, and I think I said this in our emails, was turn it into a story about a kid from Queens, you know? And it's in when they're in Queens, it's a New York story, and there's that scene where he and Donald Glover get into an argument about some kind of sandwich they both like, but which place in Queens has the better bread for the sandwich, or it's too bready or whatever, you know? And there's a bodega with a bodega cat, and there's this kind of sense that he really is this high school kid from Queens, you know? And if they would stick with that, you know, really let Peter Parker be Peter Parker, kid from Queens, I would enjoy that a lot more than watching him, you know, disrupt some festival of light in Prague or something. You know?
But, I mean, he's been stuck in New York City for, at this point, how many movies? You know, and...
He's 17. I never went to Prague when
I was 17. But the thing is,
kids
it's like, you know, there's going to be some monster or creature or villain that's going to terrorize New York, that's going to threaten destruction. Let's get some different postcard locales. I was fine with going to Europe. I thought, and you know, I appreciated what they were trying to do. I think ultimately doing what they had to do as a Marvel film ended up making it a very bifurcated experience.
And, I think next movie he should stay in Queens and fight Roy Occhio Grosso. And Roy would be a good Spider-Man villain too. That's going to come back to haunt.
Can
me,
I but, just say,
yeah, go ahead.
As soon as people in a movie get on a Ferris wheel,
yeah,
they should know they're taking their life into their
right,
hands.
Exactly. That's a very good point.
Yes.
They should say have a sign next to the sign saying you have to be this tall to get on, saying you should also be aware that you're in a comic book movie right now.
Yes.
It's like, you know.
That you're going to get stuck at the top. And something horrible is going to happen.
Right.
But you're not going to die.
Anyway, so
spoiler.
Do go see it if you've got FOMO, you can go see it. And
it's cool
whatever.
If you don't like summer heat.
Yeah, it's cool. You get inside in the dark, you know, stuff like that. But there might be other ways to spend your time too. Go see. I mean, really, if you can get to see Pavarotti, it really is an amazing thing. And it doesn't matter whether it's better if you don't like opera. If you loved opera, this might be a little bit of a problem.
Ron Howard, right?
Ron Howard. He did an amazing job with this. All right. So, and also at Downstate, it's at normal times, like at Madison Art Cinemas or whatever they're called. You can see it at night. All right. We have to take a break so we can come back. And I guess I just endorsed something, but we'll endorse some other stuff too.
I'm pitching a concept for a movie series game show about a small group of humans who do not have any superpowers. I have a meeting later today with PlayStation U Apple. I mean, if you want to get anywhere in this business, you got to meet with companies that don't exist yet. Today's show is produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield. We'll be back on Monday with our usual show about weekend news. And now, back to Colin.
All right, it's time for our excellent panel to make some recommendations to you. Jacques, why don't you go first, Jacques Lamar?
Oh, I'm leaning far back from the microphone. Sorry about that. So the first thing I want to endorse is a place I've actually not been to, but someone I trust has recommended and is asking for people to help support this restaurant in Manchester. It's on East Middle Turnpike. Yeah. It's called Rosita's. Bessie Reina, noted poet, award-winning writer, memoirist, loves this place, and she knows what she speaks when it comes to Central American food. And she said they make an amazing Central American breakfast every day. They have the Sunday buffet from 11 to 4. And she said it's really authentic Mexican and Central American food. And so she's just raving about it. And they need your business. So Rosita's on East Middle Turnpike across from what used to be Books and Birds, if you remember that store. The late lamented Books and Birds.
Well, that sounds good. And there's sort of a burrito-sized hole in my life because Los Adobes on Park Road in West Hartford closed. So I'm craving that kind of food. So Rosita's, all right.
Rosita's.
All right. Tanisha, would you like to go next?
I would. And this is probably going to make Jonathan annoyed, but so be it.
He's already annoyed, so don't worry.
I'm actually endorsing the yield sign. It's just something that I think drivers ignore. And yield means wait for someone else to pass, and then you go. I drive through a rotary every day. Mm-hmm. No one yields. And I also feel like it's a yielding of communication.
Right.
Right? We need a little more yielding in our world.
I think that's an excellent. I mean, it's sort of, you know, on Wednesdays on the Wheelhouse, rather than doing endorsements, we do feats of strength and airing of grievances. And this is kind of an airing of a grievance.
It is.
But you've also turned it into, I like the idea that you're really talking about to yield. They are asking you to be in a certain kind of emotional state.
Exactly.
Which doesn't come naturally to a lot of drivers.
And to us in 2019.
Right.
The idea that I'm going to allow someone else to go first, that I'm going to consider anything else around me before I make my move, I'm going to pay attention.
Can I endorse one of her past endorsements?
Yes, but before that, let me just say that Jonathan McPants has just chimed in. This is a great endorsement. As opposed to the opposite of annoying. And I think that's really true. That's a really good, I think that idea that if you could yield at the Rotary, maybe you could yield a little bit in other situations too. You know, let somebody else go.
Universe willing.
Somebody's in a hurry to get the coffee at Story and Soil. You say, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. You're in a hurry. Go ahead. Hopefully I'm the person you're yielding to in that situation. But anyway, now go ahead, John.
I just want – Tanisha did this before on the zipper method, and it has stuck with me. I don't know if you want to share it again real quick, Tanisha, but it seems to be a big thing in your life.
It is. I drive a lot. Driving in Connecticut is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
It's construction season. I cannot stand when someone just goes and tries to take the right into the lane. Your role is to continue to drive all the way until the arrow sign or the cone, and then one and another and another and another. You're actually stopping the traffic
Bill,
by
Bill
trying
Musman
to
Bill Musman is snapping his fingers like you're Charlie Parker right now.
That's why this
there's
needs
a lot
to be a
learn
television show
in
so
driving.
You can see me snap.
And how to be a good
Well, that's
citizen.
True. Although I will say that when they were both alive, the Maliazzi brothers used to regularly get into an argument about that. Like one of them believed what you believe. You just keep driving until there's that moment where you all have to take turns. And then the other one believed that, no, some people should, I don't know. When you say it that way, it makes sense your way. All right, Bill?
Well, just yesterday, my wife said, don't you think people are driving more aggressively since the election? And I said, I think they are. And speaking of the election, my first endorsement is a book by he's been a novelist, Ben Fountain. He wrote Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk about an Iraqi war veteran. But he has a nonfiction book called Beautiful Country, Burn Again, when The Guardian asked him to cover the 2016 election. But the book is about so much more than just the election. He argues that there have been two previous crises in America that really stretched the limits of democracy, the first being the Civil War and the second being the Great Depression. He believes we are in the midst of one right now and that we need to take that seriously. We need to look at not just what's happening right now, not just what happened during the election, but all of the roots of American rancor that led up to that. And it's a beautifully written book. He's very snarky at sometimes. He's very poetic at sometimes. I can't recommend it highly enough. Beautiful Country, Burn Again by Ben Fountain. And then just very quickly, one other nonfiction book, a book of Emily Nussbaum is the TV critic for The New Yorker. And she has a new collection of essays with a great title, I Like to Watch. And if you are a fan of The Nose, and I don't know why you wouldn't be, you will really love this book of Emily Nussbaum's TV criticism, I Like to Watch.
Well, so for my endorsements, I've already endorsed Pavarotti, but on behalf of maybe all the news panelists, first of all, I'd like to endorse the great work of Rip Torn in his lifetime. Jacques has a wonderful story about Rip Torn, which he's not going to tell on the air, but you may contact him on social media or however you'd like to contact Jacques, and he will maybe tell you that story. But in specifics, I mean, Rip Torn was this tremendous stage actor and stuff like that. He's probably going to be forever known as Artie on the Larry Sanders Show, a role which was somewhat modeled also in its excellent performance in Defending Your Life and Albert Brooks' movie about the afterlife in which Rip Torn plays kind of a lawyer slash angel. But as Artie on the Larry Sanders Show, there's kind of a tie-in here. I mean, that is really at the beginnings, the early stages of HBO beginning to produce its own high-quality content. And here's this show that is, in fact, a show that dares to question pretty much all of the aesthetics of network television and to suggest that it's mostly the work of these vain and spiritually empty people and that they don't believe in this content any more than you do and maybe even a little bit less than you do. I just watched two episodes of it again the other day right after learning of his death and it's still really great. So if you've never watched the Larry Sanders Show, it's sitting right up there on your HBO menu and you can watch it now and it's amazing. And then relatedly, unfortunately, another death, Jim Boughton. Jim Boughton, the amazing pitcher, the amazing writer. I mean, Ball 4, when the New York City Library gathered like the 150 best books of the century or something, that was the only sports book they had. Ball 4 is like really an amazing book, and it's really interestingly written, and everybody kind of focused on the real kind of salacious parts of it, but there are also some really brilliantly funny and profound parts of it. But so Jim Boughton was on our show. We were up in the Berkshires at their film festival. He'd been involved in this documentary, The Battered Bastards of Baseball, which I also endorse. It's a tremendous story about this very wild and woolly real-life minor league team. And he just turned out to be the most delightful guy. And I'm a Red Sox fan. I got no reason to like Jim Boughton. But he just was this delightful, sweet guy. He was tremendous on the show. I ran into him later that day, that night at a party, I think after the screening of the documentary. And he came over and talked about just what a great time he'd had on the show and stuff like that. So really a terrific guy, a guy who did a lot of different stuff, and a guy who dared to have kind of left-wing politics and baseball in the 1960s and 70s. Have any idea how well that went over? So a guy who will be very, very much missed. And so those two guys, terrific. I mean, Rip Torn, maybe you don't want to be around. You know, I mean, he actually did try to break into a bank in Connecticut, claiming that he was drunk and thought it was his house. But so maybe not always the easiest guy to be around.